very much. And it's great to be back. I just wish that I hadn't been organizing the seminars at the Caltech UC Center, or else I would have come here for the whole week. It's so nice to be here. So I'm going to be telling you about some work that I've been doing now for a while, and I thought that we would have finished it, and I'm not sure if the question mark or the 04 is an indication of anything, but anyway, this is work that I'm doing with Andy Brandhuber at Caltech, and the idea is that we want to try to understand how matter arises, and this would be in particular n equal to one compactifications of M theory on a G2 manifolds, how charged matter arises from the geometry. And this is basically, it's following the ideas of along the lines of work that's been done by Witten and various collaborators. So let me give you an outline of the talk. So I'll start by just some introduction and motivation, reminding you of how you can get n equal to one supersymmetry in four dimensions from various points of view. I will then tell you how, in sort of an alternative way from the standard heterotic compactification, how one can realize matter as coming from singular gauge bundles at some codimension, complex codimension 3 point in the manifold. So the manifold itself is smooth, but the gauge, the vector bundle is singular, and this is what gives rise to kernel matter. This is sort of a rather different way of thinking of the matter in our standard heterotic compactifications. And then I'll a lot of what we will be doing is going to be inspired by the story in type 2A theory, where you have some compactification on a Calabi-Yau manifold, and if the Calabi-Yau manifold is smooth, then you have no charge matter, you just have a bunch of neutral hypermultiplets and some number of vector multiplets that's tied to the geometry, but there's no charge matter. You need to go to, once again, a complex codimension 3 singularity in the manifold to see how charge hypermultiplets will arise. Finally, we'll get to the M-theory story, and we will sort of mimic, well, the M-theory story is going to be dual to the heterotic, but it will be inspired very much by what's happening in type 2A. That is, the charge matter is going to come from, in this case, and since we have a seven-dimensional real manifold, this manifold have the singularities, this is where, in this case, the charge Carroll multiplex will come from. And I've just listed here at the bottom the kind of matter that you will get. So you have the fundamental of SUN. if the singularity is of an AN type, if it's of a DN type, you can get mixed type of matter between SO and SU. And in particular, you can get if R here is equal to N, then you will get the anti-symmetric of SU. So this is sort of interesting for kernelology. And then towards the end, I'll talk about E6 and E7 singularities. Unfortunately, we have not been able to find a breaking in which you would get matter. So this is the type of singularity away from, and I will explain this, away from the singularity, we'll get some matter charged under some whatever symmetry that this is open to. So we get some interesting gauge groups here, which has some, so either you get SU3 or SU4 times SU3 plus SU2 plus U1. And this sort of almost looks like a standard model, but I'm not claiming anything about a standard model here, but you get some interesting spectrum, which is something that you would not be able to obtain, at least from a standard type 2A picture of intersecting these 6 grains, because this is not just by fundamentals, but we'll come to that. And then I'll finish with some reading statements. So the motivation, as this is sort of my kind of standard slide, that, you know, we're interested in n equal to one supersymmetric compactifications down to four dimensions in string or n theory, because, you know, after all, we're interested in making connections with the real world. Well, the real world is not supersymmetric, but this is, you know, this is, we still have some control with n equal to one supersymmetry. And there are various ways in which one can get to that, as I alluded to in the introduction. The standard sort of historic way is by compactifying on a Hadamardic, taking the Hadamardic string theory and compactifying on a Calabi-Yau threefold with some particular choice of a vector bundle. So since the original Hadamardic theory has n equal to one, you know, we break, we only preserve, we only have one covariant constant spinner, so we're left with n equal to one in four dimensions. And so there's sort of a standard way in which one can see how we get the matter in these types of compactifications, and I'll come back to that. Another way, which has been rather successful in studying some non-perturbative phenomena, is taking F-theory on a Calabi-Yau fourfold. So F-theory is this non-perturbative formulation of type 2B string theory, or so you can alternatively think of this as type 2B orientifold models. So these Calabi-Yau fourfolds, they're assumed to be elliptically fibered, and the F-theory is sort of, you can think of it as living in 12 dimensions, and so you have, that's why you have to compactify in a four-dimensional complex manifold. But the elliptic fiber here is really only there to sort of describe the tau field, the axion dilaton, in the type 2B theory. So this way you can sort of write down a nice non-perturbative description of type 2B. And then there are corresponding type 2A orientifolds, and then of course, what's most interesting for this talk, M theory of manifolds with G2 holonomy. And this is one of these special holonomy that you can have in seven dimensions. So there's no, in the holonomy for the Calabi-Yau threefold, just to remind you, is SU3. And if you have a Calabi-Yau fourfold, the holonomy is SU4. But here we are, have this seven-dimensional real manifold, and in order to be left with one covariant constant spinner, the interesting holonomy here is G2. And in these various compactifications, the matter and the gauge symmetries, they arise in rather different ways, although they are, in some sense, they're all going to be dual to each other in various ways. So just to remind you, let's take the simplest case of hadamardic theory in eight dimensions, where you compactify in a torus and you have some choice of Wilson lines. Well, this choice of Wilson lines is just another way of saying that you've made some choice of a vector bundle, and this choice of Wilson lines is now going to determine for you what kind of gauge symmetry you have. Now there's a dual, in the dual F-theory compactification, since I'm now only compactifying to eight dimensions, the manifold is not a Calabi-Yau fourfold, but it's a Calabi-Yau twofold, that is a K3, and it has to be elliptically fibered. So here we have the torus that represents the axion dilaton tau, and then we have a base, and depending on where you're on the base, this torus will change its shape, and it may, you know, have certain cycles. As shrink to zero, you have basically singular torus over certain points, and the structure of those singularities will tell you what kind of gauge symmetry that you have. So this is sort of a nice example of how one, in rather different ways, here in the rather geometric picture, finds the gauge symmetries, while here it's determined in terms of the Wilson line. So that's a rather simple example of this kind of duality. Now, let me just remind you, because this is, as I said, you know, the way that we're going to think about the duals for the M-theory compactification on the G2 manifold will be rather different from the standard picture of a Hadamardic compactification on a Calabi-Yau threefold. So as you, I'm sure you're all aware of, if we take the Hadamardic EA plus D8 string, and you compactify in a threefold, then there are certain geometric data associated with this threefold, that we have a certain number of Kähler deformations denoted by H11 and a certain number of complex structure deformations denoted by H21. And in the simplest choice of vector bundle, one takes the one factor here in the 1E8 to be trivial, so we're left with just with the E8 that we started with. And in the other one, we choose to say that the vector bundle is morphic to the tangent bundle. And so since the structure group here, because of the SU3 holonomy, is SU3, the gauge group that you're left with is E6 cross E8. And for this particular standard embedding, when we now want to look for the massless mode, the chiral matter, all that one has to do is to realize that the Dirac zero modes are in one-to-one correspondence with certain elements of these cohomology, these Dolbeau cohomology classes. And because these Dolbeau cohomology classes in turn are related to the number of Kähler deformations, the number of complex structure deformations, we have this very nice correspondence between the number of zero modes, that is the number of 27s or the 27 bars for B6, and the number of complex structure deformations and the number of Kähler deformations. So this is the standard result, that if you want to look for a three-generation model, you want a theory with a Calabi-Yau manifold where the Euler number is plus or minus 6. And that's, you know, there have been lots of these kinds of models constructed in this perturbative setting. But when we, now eventually, the way that we are going to go about to find how matter arises in something that's going to be dual to one of these G2 compactifications, then the matter will arise in a rather different way. So here it was it was more of a global property of the manifold that told you about the matter. Because the manifold is smooth, and the existence of a certain number of charged chiral multiplets had to do with the topology of the manifold, but it didn't really matter where you were on the manifold. So to get back to the M theory compactification and to give some more motivation why we're interested in this, the advantage of looking at M theory, let's say, versus the Hadrodic, is that everything is going to be encoded in the geometry. As I just said, you know, if you look at Hadrodic on a Calabi-Yau threefold, you also have to specify the vector bundle. But here, this choice of vector bundle in the dual M theory compactification is going to be encoded in the geometry. So everything in principle can be read off from the manifold itself. Now the problem is that the geometry is not as simple as that the Calabi-Yau threefold, because we no longer have a complex manifold, so we don't have the same tools and use homomorphy and all of this other beautiful structure that we had, special geometry and so on. Not available to us anymore. But still, you know, it turns out that these singularities in the geometry, in the G2 manifold, is of a conical type, and the base of this cone will be a six-dimensional real manifold, alternatively, it's a complex manifold. So they're actually, to describe the singularities themselves, you have a nice complex geometry to work with. Okay, so let me now give you the basic idea for how we're going to go about and how Witten and various collaborators have looked at this problem. So you now kind of have to forget about what I told you about the old story of getting matter in the Hadrodic compactification. Instead, we're going to use a duality in seven dimensions. So if I compactify the Hadrodic theory on a T3, with the choice of Wilson lines, then this is dual to M theory on some singular general K3. And now, why is the K3 singular? I mean, if you blow up the K3, what happens on the hadronic side? Then you will just get a bunch of U1s. So so generically, if you just had Wilson lines that took your E8 across E8 and just and plus
the it's singular because it's an ideal engagement.
Yeah. That's right. Exactly. So generically, the K3 would be smooth, and then you would just have abelian H-symmetries. Exactly. So,
if I naively complain that that's just singular and I shouldn't consider it, how do I know that this is a sensible limit on either side?
Okay, well, so the matter on the M theory side comes from, so now you're looking at this singular K3, you might worry, it's singular, so something goes wrong. Well, what goes wrong is the fact that if you blew up, let's say that you smoothed out the K3, so let's say that we're looking at a K3 in which you have some, the singularity of this AN type, then there are N P1s which you can blow up in order to resolve the singularity. Now, so these P1s, these two cycles, there are, since we're looking at M theory, there are M2 brains which wrap these two cycles. And when you have when these two cycles have some finite size, then they're massive and they can be neglected. So this is in the limit when you just have, this would correspond in the hadronic theory to a choice of Wilson line, which just told you that you have some, abelian gauge symmetry. But now when you shrink these two cycles to zero, then all of a sudden you get some new masses, degrees of freedom that you forgot about before. So this is sort of similar to the conifold, the conifold story of Andy, back before that, but where there was a singularity, and you deal with the singularity by saying that, well, you forgot some degrees of freedom, which became massless in this limit. And so the new degrees of freedom that occur at the singularity, and that's the way of resolving the issue. You might say, well, why should I consider this? Of course, not all singularities, I mean, these days there are other types of time-like singularities. It's not clear that they correspond to something. Yes, Gary.
So I guess, just to follow up on that, so on one hand, we say, well, these are exact solutions to string theory.
Yeah.
And so it's okay if the curvature is blowing up, because normally you worry that alpha prime corrections are getting large.
Right.
But if you know it's an exact solution, even when the curvature blows up, you don't worry about that.
Right.
But I guess in Andy's case, and maybe in these examples also, the real reason that you sort of believe that the theory is completely consistent is because, well, you have a low energy effective description with these extra degrees of freedom, which everything works.
Right.
But is there an understanding at the level of sort of conformal field theory on these backgrounds or a sigma model that you can sort of go through these singularities and strings don't get disrupted in some sense?
I don't think, since this is M theory,
you don't have strings.
We don't have any
explanation like that. It's all an effective field theory argument, which is really a low energy argument.
That's
right. So,
that's
right. So it could still be that at high energies the singularities cause a problem? I mean, you don't see a problem at low energies, but maybe.
Right.
We also believe that it fits into the web of dualities. It's dual to things like this, which don't seem to have any singularity.
Right. If you believe it's equivalent to this non-singular description,
If you didn't have...
This is, of course, a tautological argument.
That's right. So the duality is telling you the singularity is harmless.
but that's right. So if someone had just given you this M theory on a singular K3, then you didn't know that it was dual to anything else, then maybe you would have to be a little more skeptical.
I mean, singularities are almost all singularities. If it was a string theory, we would know that string theory is not singular on that space.
That's right. In case of the orbifolds,
even there are singular. Actually, there are. I think of that.
Right.
The ones that have actually Hess gauge groups are singular CFTs.
Yes.
They're not orbifolds.
That's right. So that's the whole point. That your description, the conformal field theory description, breaks down.
Right.
Now here we don't have a conformal field theory description, but.
So you don't know whether it breaks down or not.
Well, and worse than that, we don't even know if these are exact solutions to all orders of the Zen theory, right?
So right. Well, I mean, there is no.
Well, I think
there's no expansion factor, so I'm not sure if you.
So we don't know that it's an exact solution, and so it's basically our belief that this is equivalent, this duality is true, that's telling us the singularity. The only evidence is this low energy effective theory.
Yeah, I don't think that that's a fair description of it.
Is there a possibility of understanding how the geometry is corrected even in M theory?
Well, the first order of
prime correction in type 2A and try to live in there.
Sure, but you can only do a couple orders.
Yeah.
And of course, when it's singular, the curvature is blowing up, and you know, a couple orders aren't going to help much. You sort of know what happens in all orders.
You believe the alpha prime correction in type 2A.
Sort of looking at some corrections in there. You can't follow that very far if the curvature is converging.
So, I mean, I guess by duality, this is, in some sense, telling us something about M theory. That
believe the duality.
Right, if you believe the duality, right, so it's I guess that's, you know, one way of using duality. You compute something and you see if it makes sense, and then you try to come into the consistency, you push duality or you push your results further. So, yeah, so in that sense, we are on much weaker, you know, ground, or thinner ice, I should say, than, let's say, the Strom and Jerichomi Cole type argument. But the spirit is the same. So what I wanted to say was that so we know that these M2 brains, when they're wrapped a two cycle, they are the ones that give rise to the non-abelian, they're filling out the sort of off diagonal elements in these they basically give rise to the W bosons, if you wish, they give rise to these enhanced ADE gauge symmetries. Now the problem is that if we were not interested in a seven-dimensional theory, we're interested in a four-dimensional theory. So now you have to, on both sides, use the usual kind of argument that you, if I compactify on some three-dimensional manifold on either side, and it's the same manifold, then I should get the same theory. The problem is that, of course, if you were to just reduce it, let's say you compactify it on T3, then you would just end up with too much supersymmetry. So you need to have some non-trivial vibration over some base B on either side, and then use the standard sort of adiabatic argument to argue that, well, and then the way that you would, the non-trivial vibration will have to be such that on the heterotic side, since we're looking at a heterotic compactification under four dimensions with n equal to one supersymmetry, this is a Calabi-Yau manifold with SU3 holonomy. And on this side here, this K3, elliptically fibered K3, over the same base, is now going to give rise to a G2 manifold. So that's sort of the consistency conditions that you have in order for the theory to have n equal to one supersymmetry. So the question is now, what is happening with this gauge symmetry? And in particular, you know, you have this non-trivial fibration, so it could be that this fiber here is not exactly the same everywhere over the base, just like with the K3 itself. You know, this elliptic fiber here was not varying, and you got enhanced gauge symmetry exactly because of that. And the matter will now actually come from having the K3 fiber change over some certain isolated points in the base.
Could you remind me, do people have an idea how much the moduli space of the G2 holonomy manifolds is filled up by these K3 fiber cases? Is this just a very special set, or is this most in some sense?
Well, the problem is that not too much is known about G2 manifolds to start with. Mm-hmm. And Joyce, in his book, and I guess in his various papers, he discusses the existence of, in theory, compactifications that are K3 fiber. But I don't know. Just based on, and once again, I'm going to use this as now a duality argument. Based on the fact that there are so many Calabi-Yau manifolds, and as I will say in a second, the existence of a T3 fiber Calabi-Yau manifold is true if the manifold itself has a mirror. A mirror symmetry, we know, is very common. Then there will have to be an M theory compactification corresponding to that. And in fact, there has to be an M-theory compactification to every choice of vector bundle. And this M-theory compactification is not just any M-theory compactification, it's one in which there's a K3 factor. So there has to be lots of these. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that because there are lots of them, there could also be even more there that are not K3 fiber. So I must say I just don't know.
Now, on the heteroid side, there is this big issue with the singular fibers, right?
Right.
Holster. What on the K3? That's a different singularity from the singularity we're talking about, because this.
When you say the singular fiber on
the T3, for generic lobby, the T3 collapses in different places. You have these networks that Morrison describes.
Yeah. No. So that's right. Here we will assume. So we will be looking at models which are easier in the sense that the manifold here, we always assume the manifold is smooth.
Are there there are actually some which are genuinely.
Let me rephrase that. We will be actually looking at non-compact cases. So what I wanted to say is that the point in which something interesting will happen, that is, there will be a jump in the type of vector bundle. I haven't told you about it. This is where the matter will be localized.
Yes.
It's not because the T3 fiber becomes singular, it's because the vector bundle. But I'm sure that if you take a generic Calabi-Yau manifold, then there will be points and you will have things like conifold singularities.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, can you now kind of what happens if you at the same time as you have a singular bundle, you also have a singular fiber?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're at a point where you have like conifold type singularity.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking a little bit about that, sort of along these lines, but
I mean, I think with the places with the fiber, fiber can be singular without all space being so.
That's true. Yeah, but here we're saying that that nothing happens with
nothing
the fiber.
Right. Yes. Okay.
Everything here. So the enhanced, the enhanced gauge symmetry and the matter is all because of the vector bundle in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So here everything is non-geometrical, and on this side everything is geometrical. But it is true that the most interesting case is where you have both. So let me just very quickly review what happens in the heterotic perspective of this story. I already started to allude to it. So the statement by Stromnyi-Jao and Zaslav is that if you have a manifold M and it has a mirror W, then Stromnyi-Jao and Zaslav showed that in that case the Calabi-Yau threefold has to be a T3 fibration. And so the statement about mirror symmetry here is now a statement about sort of T duality on the T3 fiber. So this is I just wanted to state this because most of the time when we think about compact Calabi-Yau 3 manifolds, we don't think of them as T3 fibrations. In fact, it's only at a particular point in the moduli space, like the large radius limit, let's say, of the quintic. It's only in that limit that you see explicitly the T3 fiber. So this notion is a notion that's useful sort of when you look at non-compact cases, and that's the way that we're going to apply the duality. So if we have this T3 vibration, then over each point in the base B, there's a gauge symmetry G. And the question is now, how do we get the charged massless matter? And since I claim that we're looking at a case when the fiber will, just stays finite. So there's nothing that happens with the vibration. So the only way that you can get charged matter is if there is a change in the vector bundle at some particular point in the base. Gary, are you?
No, okay.
So the and the way to realize this is that, well, just as for the standard case, we have to look for the zero modes of the Dirac operator. So for the compact Calabi-Yau, this was straightforward, at least in the case of the standard embedding. Because the zero modes of the Dirac operator, in that case, were just related to these cohomology classes, and we could need to read off, and it was sort of a a global statement. Now, because we have this vibration, then now we can turn the question into a question about the zero modes over the base and over the T3. And if in these adiabatic arguments, as usual, we assume that the base is very large. And so to get a zero mode of M, we have to have a zero mode of the T3. And to get a zero mode of the T3, then you have to require that the monodromy around each of the S1s and the T3 has to be trivial. That is, representation has to be invariant under some subgroup of the original structure group here. So if you take the simplest example of the gauge symmetry EC is E6, and the structure group is SU3, and as always, we'll just restrict to one of the EAs, then the number of 27s of E6 is, then you have to solve this equation, and so we're looking at here for the representations of the structure group, and the fundamental representations, because that's sort of what is the commutant of the E6, so you have 3 of SU3, and the 3 of SU3 has trivial monodromy if there's a point at which the structure group, it becomes SU2 instead of SU3. And so then the gauge symmetry sort of effect, well, at this particular point, it's as if you had a gauge symmetry which was E7, but it only happens at one point. So the matter that you're going to get now is you look at how the adjoint decomposes when E7 breaks to E6, and that tells you that you will get 127 of E6. So this is, you know, this is very much a local argument, while the old way of seeing how the matter arose in a heterotic compactification is a statement about the global matter. So this is something that I don't know if it's understood at all, you know, how you could kind of try to translate this kind of a picture to a statement about the global manifold, how you could sort of argue the existence of new modes at particular points in a singular labial, let's say. This is, we're looking at in the non-compact setting.
So it's the gauge bundle of the collabial singular?
The gauge bundle is singular, yes, that's the statement. So everywhere, you have the same gauge bundle everywhere except for at some localized points. This would be co-dimension 6 or co-dimension 3 points in the manifold. And it's only at those points. If you didn't have this, if the gauge bundle just stayed the same, well, then you wouldn't have any matter at all. Because the only way that you can have this matter is if you have this kind of phenomena. Basically, otherwise, you wouldn't have any zero modes to wrap up. It all boils down to that. So let me try to speed up a little bit. The type 2A perspective is, as I said, you know, this is the idea that we'll be using. And similarly, you have a K3 vibration, and this idea goes back to Katz and Baffa, you know, in 96. So you have a K3 fiber over a base P1, and if this K3 is singular, then it will give rise to some gauge symmetry, just like we just talked about. But in this case, of course, you have control of it because of string theory. Now, the question is the same: how do you get massless charge type multiplets? Well, now rather than having a vector bundle that becomes singular, you will have that the K3, the singularity, will jump. So if you had some ADA singularity, and if the G goes to G prime at some particular point, then this is sort of the analogy of what we had with the heterotic picture. This is where you ever have the matter localized. And the argument is very much the same, that if you have a decomposition of this, there's a scalar in the adjoint of G prime, and G prime is only realized at a particular point where this scalar, the bevel of that scalar, is equal to zero, and away from that, the G prime decomposes into G and times a U1. So now you have, if you decompose the adjoint of G prime, then you will get certain representations which will have a certain U1 charge, and then once again, it's the same story. You solve this Dirac equation for that particular, you know, you will have a certain number of zero modes by solving this Dirac equation. And if you don't have a jump in the singularity, well, then there's simply no solution to this equation. So that's the thing. And the kind of matter that you will get in this kind of configuration is that if you have a singular point where you have a n at one point and it's broken to an a n minus 1, then you will get an s u n or cross a u 1 and a fundamental. And if you have some, you can get bifundamentals by this breaking an s u p plus q into two pieces, s u p and s u q, and then you get bifundamental, and you can do similar things for these s. Yes?
Yeah. Do q1s turn enter into the energy action at all?
In this case, they are basically just, right, no, in this particular story, they are not, I mean, they're important for understanding the, these representations will have a charge into the u1, but as far as the lower energy factor action, yes, no, they're just, in fact, this u1 in some sense, that this corresponding charge here is sort of related to the base space that you can compact the time on. So this is the basic idea that we're going to be using. And what Acharya and Witten realized was that, well, we take the same K3 as we had before now, and we, instead of having a two-dimensional base B, now we have a three-dimensional base B, and the argument is the same, that we can only get charged in this chiral matter if this K3, if the singularity changes over some localized points in the base B. And they used this local construction and found that, and so the answer for this, and this is our work is extending, sort of in parentheses, this is what we have found, that the conical space that this G2 manifold is a conical space, and there's a base Y, and so this base is a complex three-dimensional manifold, and this manifold is an orbifold of some complete intersection of hypersurface in a weighted projective space, or generally in a toric variety. So here is, you can still sort of use, it turns out you can use this machinery that's familiar from Calabi-Yau manifolds. Of course, the difference is that Y is not a Calabi-Yau manifold, but it's still something that we could describe in a toric variety. And you may ask, so how do you know that these are actually, these models actually do have G2, a mixed metric with the G2 holonomy, and that's actually not known, apart from the case, the simplest case in which this space is just the projective space P3 itself. But there is a nice duality, or rather this, you can take this 11-dimensional M-theory compactification and reduce it on the circle to the type 2A compactification, and then you can see how this geometry is related to intersecting D6 frames. And since the intersecting D6 frames, if they're rotated in a supersymmetric way, they correspond to any one compactification. So hence, by using the type 2A M theory relationship, we know that these manifolds or these configurations have to admit G2, because if they didn't admit G2, well, then you didn't have any plus one supersymmetry. So that, as usual, you have to use a lot of indirect arguments, but it's consistency. You know, if you can't compute something one way, you know, you try to figure it out some other way. And, we don't need the metric per se. We're not interested in it. The kind of things that we're interested in, the metric is not needed. It's just the existence of it, and we infer that indirectly. Okay. Let me then turn to, you know, what is the actual construction that we use to realize how these conical singular spaces are made up. Well, we're basically using an idea that goes back to Kronheimer or Witten and company used this idea of what's known as the hypercalar quotient construction. And this hypercalar quotient construction is very much analogous to the idea of that I described for the type 2A, namely, you start out with some singular R4, your ALE space, R4 mod some gamma, and gamma is an SU2, and then you, what's known as unfolding the singularity, and as you, as I will come to in a second, as you look at how you deform the singularity away from the given singularity that you're originally describing, those deformations will describe for you this base space. So you look at the one, you look at the three-dimensional parameter space, the deformation space of the singularity. So this deformation space is like the deformation space in the type 3 theory, in which as you go away from that singular point, you're describing a less severe singularity. And that's the main idea. So let me try to describe this in a little more detail. And this hypercalar quotient construction is really nothing but the way that we're representing it, it's sort of using a quiver n equal to 1, a quiver representation of an n equal to 1 b equal to 4 dimensional supersymmetric gauge theory. So if we be interested in this ALE space, the K3, which is some R4, and in the simplest case is that's R4 mod this discrete Zn plus 1 symmetry, then the hypercalar construction replaces this here by by taking n plus 1 hypermultiplets, which has each of them, there's a, you know, there are these four scalars, and so you have that corresponds to the h to the n plus 1, and then there's this quotient by k, and k in our case is u1 to the n. Now, the quotient doesn't just impose the gauge symmetry, but it also imposes the moment maps that are basically just the d and f term in the n equal to 1 theory. So this is the way, I mean, this is the mathematical setup, but it's basically just you're trying to solve d and f term equations for this u1 to the n theory. And you have some, a bunch of U1s, and then they are just charged in this, in sort of the standard way. And I guess I should have sort of drawn it. You know, you have this quiver diagram where, well, now I've added an extra U1 here, but then you know, the dots here correspond to the U1s, and then the hypermultiplets are the, with some errors here, are the links that go between the U1s, and that's why you have, let's say, take this phi one here, it has charge plus one with respect to the first u1 and charge minus one with respect to the second one. So if we have here u1 one and here u1 two, then this is a hypermultiple, this is this first multiple here, phi one, and then so on. So now we basically want to solve these, you solve the condition for having zero, you're looking for the vacuum solutions, so you just set these equal to zero, and then you have these parameters, the CJs and the RJs, so the complex and the real parameter, and in the case when these are all equal to zero, that's when you haven't resolved the singularity at all. And what we want to do now is we want to partially resolve the singularity, and that's what I refer to by sort of unfolding the singularity. So we take all of these RJs and CJs equal to zero, except for, let's say in the simplest case, the last ones. And so that means if you now originally had these n plus one hypermultiplets, you can pull out the last hypermultiplet, because this last hypermultiplet would not be charged, is only charged with respect to the last U1, right? In this charge table here, this hypermultiplet here is only charged with respect to the last U1. up here, I mean, there's in this, in the Kruger theory, of course, there's this, I'm looking at the extended diagram, so I've added another U1, but that is eliminated from here. So in that sense, it's this guy is only charged under this, and so I can, this is what allows me to rewrite this hyper-Kähler quotient in this fashion. So I have, this is what we started with, I do the unfolding, I can pull out one of the hypermultiplets, and then this by itself, of course, now is a new hyper-Kähler quotient, but now describing a space which corresponds to, and so if this was an an singularity, this is an an minus one singularity. And then these non-zero, these three real non-zero parameters, they are now describing the parameter space. When we set them equal to zero, then of course we're back to the original. So that's the description of having the singularity only at one point, and everywhere else you have lesser singularity.
Wait, so orientation are functions on the base, or they're actually the coordinates of the base?
They're the coordinates of the base.
Of the base.
Right. So these are some local coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now, not sure how much I should. Well, anyway. So, as usual, I just, when I flashed it, I didn't say anything about, well, the notation is the standard one where you have, you have, you know, for each hypermultiplet, there are two parallel multiplets. And then, so there's MI and MI bar, and then there's a complex conjugate of those. And now you will introduce, one introduces coordinates for these guys, and that's what I've written on the next transparency here. So this first equation is just the F-term equation for the first N minus one U1s. And that is just now equal to zero, so that's telling you that they are pairwise identical. And so if you introduce some coordinates that z is equal to this pair, and then you have coordinates x and y for the products of them, then you will now, you can then write down this identity, which is just telling you that you have an with this one non-zero this one non-zero complex number is the deformation parameter of this an singularity. So when x and y and z are equal to zero, this describes for you an an singularity if c is non-zero.
And why should there be a bar? Is it
an
h?
Wait, excuse me.
This bar is in some of the those m's.
Well, so this is just the, well. It's,
or is it just transposed? That just being transposed?
Well, that's just the two components. No, it's not complex one. So the two components are just m and m bar. Those are the two components of the hypermultiplet.
Okay.
The annotation. So you have.
But they're both sort of complex coordinates.
Yeah, that's right. They're all both complex coordinates. Exactly. So you have the standard, you know, equation for a deformation of an an singularity into an an minus one singularity. And then there's now a way in which you could define, in terms of these coordinates that you've introduced, the z and the w, you can introduce, well, z was actually the product of them, so you can introduce two more complex coordinates and yet two more complex coordinates, but there's a, there's still the U1 action, the U1 to the N action. And so this, with a little bit of descaling, this now just corresponds to the standard projective condition for a projective space of this type, 1, 1, and N. So the base is this, and then the, we haven't talked about the D term, but the D term is basically telling you, that's giving you the conical structure of the space. So you have, once again, at the tip of this of the tip of this cone, you have this an singularity, and that is telling you that the matter, just by the same argument as in type 2A theory, is telling you that you have an SU n gauge theory with n fundamentals under the SUM. Like, well, with one fundamental under the transforming under the SUM. Well, since we started a little bit late, I want to get a little bit more time. So this was the basic construction of the A singularities. And what we want to do now in the corresponding gauge symmetry. Question? Yeah.
Yeah, so this A, you're left only with an A, N singularity.
Well, you started with an A, N, and then you're left with an A, N minus 1.
And so the seven manifold is what singularity?
So the singularity that you're describing at the tip of the cone is an A, N singularity. And then away from the cone, at the tip of the cone, you have an A, N minus 1 singularity. So now, what we want to do is we want to use this construction as a covering space and describe the D and eventually the E singularities as well. And what we're using here is just the sort of we're taking apart a DN singularity, because the DN singularity is generated by two group elements. There's the one. Which is this, I wrote down as the T generator here, which looks exactly like an A, that of an A2N minus 5 singularity. And then you have this S generator, which is sort of a non-abelian, or non-abelian Z2 symmetry. And this is the one that basically is telling you that you have a, that gives you the D invariance. So if I started with some coordinate Z1, and Z2, and these are the same Z1 and Z2 that I had before, then X and Y are invariant under T, right, because it's a phase symmetry. And then there's another coordinate Z, which is the product of Z1 and Z2, and so they satisfy this relation. Now, the under S, X, Y, and Z transform in a non-trivial way, and these coordinates, capital X, Y, and Z, are the invariants, the one set of invariants under this S. And so then you get this standard relation for the Dn, right, where you have this kind of cross term ZY squared and then minus Z to the N minus 1. This is the standard defining equation in C3 for a Dn singularity. Now the problem is that if we want to describe deformations of this, what we want to do is we use the deformations here and we want to look for those that are invariant under S and to describe the deformations under D. So the problem is that there are only N minus 2 of these deformations which are invariant. So roughly when you take this kind of orbifold action, you're left with roughly half of them because you're acting with this non-trivial Z2. And those half are the ZIs that if I just think of two points basically symmetrically around the origin, then this XY gets deformed in this fashion, and then the D singularity now will be deformed in a similar fashion. So I'm just left with an equation in which I have N minus 2 deformations rather than N. Because for Dn singularity, we know that there are n ways in which I can deform. So this is a problem. I wouldn't be able to represent all of my deformations. So I couldn't represent all possible types of breakings of the Dn singularity. So the trick is to realize that one can actually use a larger An singularity and use a singular transformation in terms of these little c to the minus 1. So you see that this is a problem if z is equal to 0. But we will just go ahead and ignore that for now. So if we started with these types of invariants, then they transform into this equation. And now it's easy to convince oneself that of these two n deformations, n of them survive, and they are represented here in red in this fashion. So I've now been able to describe for you all the deformations of the DM. But the question is, what are these deformations of, are these deformations that I'm describing, are they really describing the deformations of DM because I have this singular transformation? Well, in general, this is definitely a problem, but to get around it, we're only interested in particular limits. We're only interested in let's say, a limit in which, for example, we choose all of the deformations here equal to t, and then we're looking at the singular point where x is equal to y is equal to 0 and z is equal to plus minus t is equal to 0. So you see that this is equal to, you have an an minus 1 plus an af minus 1 singularity at that particular point. Now, this is in the covering space, in the A2 minus 1 space, deformation space. If I'm looking at the, in the DN space, then there is another singularity, which is also an AN minus 1 singularity. And then, so the question is, this in this case, I've been able to describe the AN minus 1 plus AN minus 1 singularity. Rather, there's a, I have a Z2 identification of these two AN minus 1 singularities, and I'm describing that in the covering space, and in the DN space, this is now, I've deformed the DN singularity to an AN minus 1 singularity. So, and at this point, Z is non-zero because T is non-zero. And when you take the limit T goes to 0, because x and y are already equal to 0, capital X is equal to 0, this dangerous term, the z to the minus 1, is not a problem because x already vanished. So if I'm approaching the singularity along a particular deformation, then the problem of having this singular coordinate transformation never arises. So this allows me to, this little trick allows me to describe all the possible deformations, and it also allows me to take certain limits in which I can regain the original singularity. So in taking the limit when t goes to 0, then the an minus 1 becomes a dn, and the a2n minus 1 becomes this an minus 1 plus an minus 1. So now the, how do we apply this in our Hyper-Taylor quotient construction? Well, rather than saying that we started with a Z2n and only unfolded one particular U1, that is, let's say we only took one of these pairs to be zero, but if we take more than one of those pairs to zero, then the breaking of SU2n will not be just to SU2n minus 1, but there will be multiple gauge groups. So, in particular, let's say that you take r equal to n here, then we get exactly the breaking that I talked about in previous transparency, SUn cross SUn. So you started with an SU2n, and in this quiver diagram, I'm now, let's say, giving, not, I have a non-zero moment map, let's say, for this U1, and then some other U1 here. Then you will get one enhanced gauge symmetry for this factor, another one, well, in general, say, for these guys, and then another one for this one here. And that's what these three gauge, enhanced gauge symmetries correspond to. And then you just repeat the process by identifying your coordinates. You see that depending on the x and the y's and the z are zero, you will get these various enhanced gauge symmetries. And rather than having just one U1, you will have several U1s, and your fields will be charged in a particular way. And now this is where the generalization from the weighted projective space to a toric variety will occur, because I have, basically I'm just looking at a linear sigma model. I have a certain kind of field, they charge under the U1, and this is just an alternative description of a toric variety. But you might say, well, wait a minute here. You have too many complex coordinates. You have 12 complex coordinates. 6 complex coordinates, so that's a 12-dimensional space. that's way too much because you want to describe a 7-manifold. Well, we have 2 U1s, so we reduce that to 10. But in addition, we have to find a relation between the moment maps so that we only have a 3-dimensional parameter space. The original parameter space that I described for you here, if I have 2 of those, is a 6-dimensional because we have 2 pairs of these, so that makes 6 dimensions. But we find a relation between them, and that relation now is going to give you a hypersurface. And so that hypersurface, after you've taken that into account, and also use the conical structure, it's going to describe for you a 7-dimensional manifold. So the counting in the end works out. And let me just show you how you can do the same thing for, say, an E6 singularity. And I'm just showing this because you get this rather interesting matter. So you repeat the story. You start with, you have some gamma, and this gamma corresponds to binary tetrahedral group, and which has, in addition to the T in the death generator that gives you the D4 singularity or the B2 binary tetrahedral group, it also has this U generator. And you write down the invariance, and you find, indeed, the equation for an E6 singularity. And the idea now is that you want to once again look for deformations of the E6 singularity in terms of invariant deformations of the original A singularity. Now, there's no way around, like I did for the D, so there's only one deformation of the A singularity that survives as invariant under all these U and the S transformations, U and S projections. So if I start with an A3, and it has this form, this deformation has this particular form, then I deform my original E6 singularity with these bunch of terms, and then it turns out that the E6 is broken to an A2 cos A1 singularity. And if you see what happens to the matter, the kind of matter that you get from this kind of representation, then just wrote it down here at the very bottom. So at the tip of the column we have an E6 singularity, and then away from the tip of the column, the E6 has been broken to SU3 cos SU3 cos SU2 cos U1, and the 78, the adjoint of the E6, has been decomposed, and the chiral part that you're left with, well, there's some bifundamental matter here, but what's interesting is that you're getting this something that's charged under all the 3 gauge groups. And I think this is the first time that we've seen something of this sort that clearly cannot come from anything that has a type 2A description in terms of intersecting D6 friends. Because any type of intersecting D6 friends is an open string that goes between one D6 friend and another. So the best thing that you can do is to describe bifundamental matter. But here, we have a description of some matter which is charged, non-trivially charged, into all of these 3 gauge groups. And so this is where I think M theory has an advantage over the standard perturbative type 2A description. So if there was a type 2A description, this would have to be something that is strongly coupled region. And after all, we know that describing PEM singularities in general is very difficult. And there's nothing like an oriental plane that describes for you E singularities. Well, in the D singularities, we have the oriental plane, and that's basically, you can lift that to be at the Hitchin space, and that's what is telling you about interesting matter that stretches between the strings.
So here, your flavor is a gate. One of the entities is flavor.
Well, that would be the, I mean, here it's not a compactification. So if there was, so but that's ideally, that's what you would like to say, that one of these symmetries, so at this point I think that all of the couplings are weak, or zero, because they are really coming from the 7-dimensional theory, and you haven't really compactified them anything, because non-compact model. But if you compactify, then the hope, I guess, would be that one of these SU3s indeed would be the flavor, and then you could claim that, well, we have some part of the standard model. Of course, in a compact model, you would have to, there's an issue about the anomaly, and you would have to, you have more than one singularity in order to cancel the gauge anomaly. Mm-hmm. So there would be other contributions from other singularities. But if, in principle, if you had a couple of these singularities, you could account for matter in standard type model description. So we unfortunately, we had hoped to describe 16 of SO10. We hoped that this E6 breaking would go to SO10. Mm-hmm. But the only breakings that we were allowed to describe, since we were using the covering space, and the old covering space only allowed us a particular deformation, and it turned out to be this one, well, in some sense, maybe this is more interesting than being able to describe SO10, because it's not clear that SO10 is anything preferred. But this, I think, is, I'm not sure how important it is, but at least the fact that you're getting some interesting matter that is sort of novel from a type 2A point of view, I think that's sort of the important to take home. Not that this could describe the three families of quarks, some of the quarks, the ones that are, you know, transformed to doublets. So I think that's more of a coincidence. But the fact that it's all a bunch of bunch. So let me just quickly summarize what I told you, and then I'm going to keep you from the cookies. So I think the main point of this is that one can learn a lot from the geometry. We already knew this from type 2A compactifications, but that was for N equal 2 theories, and well, those are non-chiral. So here we have chiral models, and we have learned how to describe certain matter configurations charged under potentially phonological interest in a gauge group. I think that the main question still is that how do we implement this understanding, this local understanding in a compact setting? And the problem is that there are very few examples of compact G2 manifolds where you get interesting matter configurations. So, but as someone was saying, you know, how do I know that how many of the G2 manifolds are K3 vibrations? Well, I don't know, but they just have to be many of them, because we know that there are plenty of ergodic complications. So once again, you know, we don't know too much about M theory, but by duality, there should be a lot that one can learn, and hopefully this will, you know, give us interesting information about ergodic theories, and eventually, you know, the question is, how can you break super?